Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Director General Yumkela, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished delegates. It's a really very great pleasure for me to be here this afternoon, and I should like to start by extending my warm thanks to UNIDO and to Director General Yumkela for this invitation. I think it's a very concrete and practical example of the sort of cooperation and cohesion to which we aspire in the United Nations system. And it's for us a very great opportunity also to be able to talk about this obscure field of intellectual property to you here in UNIDO in Vienna. Director General Yumkela is, I think, one of our thought leaders in the multilateral system, in the United Nations system. And as you are all well aware, he's the leader of the energy group within the Chief Executive's Board. And this is an additional reason for my gratitude at this opportunity today. Let me start by saying just a few words very, very quickly about the World Intellectual Property Organization, because it being in Geneva, you're perhaps not so familiar with it. We have 184 member states. We are a specialized agency of the United Nations. And we have three really main areas of activity. In the first place, we are a service provider to the global economy, and we run a number of systems which make it easier to get intellectual property in internationally or in more than one country. Under those, about 160,000 international patent applications are filed every year, about 40,000 international trademark applications, and a lesser number of design applications. And we also have a dispute resolution centre for disputes concerning intellectual property. A second area of our activity concerns the development of the international architecture, regulatory architecture, if you like, where we are custodians of some 20-odd multilateral treaties, and we have a number of activities in process under discussion for extending intellectual property protection to traditional knowledge systems, traditional cultural expressions, to broadcasters' rights, and in the area also of design protection, and in the area of exceptions to copyright protection to give access to published works for the visually impaired or the blind. And our final area of activity is, of course, that we have a very strong development focus in the organisation, with a development capacity building program and a development agenda that has been agreed amongst the member states that is a very important part of our program. Intellectual property itself, let me say one word about intellectual property. It is, of course, at its broadest, a mechanism, really, for translating knowledge into commercial assets. And I put it rather broadly there, but I think that when one thinks about it, is exactly what intellectual property's mission in life is, to translate knowledge into commercial assets, and it does so through a number of ways. One is incentivizing investment in innovation by offering the prospect of a property right. Another is providing a framework for trading intellectual assets, and this is of particular importance for the transfer of technology. And in addition, it has an important role in relation to marks and brands in creating order in distributed markets in particular to enable producers and consumers to be identified. Now, when one looks at the innovation landscape in the world today, I think that one of the things that one notices very easily is that this is a landscape that is subject of very rapid and very radical change. And let me make a few observations, if I may, about the changes that are occurring in the innovation landscape, because I think these changes are informing, or should be informing, the policy responses that we will have as an international community to innovation in the coming decades. The first thing I think that one can notice, and this is, of course, what we mean, I think, in a sense, by the knowledge economy, the first thing that we notice is a great intensification of investment in knowledge creation. Last year, or in recent years, some $1.1 trillion has been invested worldwide in research and development, in the creation of new knowledge. And that compares with only 500 billion, so it's double the amount some 10 or 15 years ago in 1996. And indeed, on one estimate now of the global value added of knowledge-intensive industries and technology-intensive industries in world economic output that was done by the OECD, it puts it at around about 30% of global economic output, the knowledge-intensive and the technology-intensive industries, around about 30%, or some $15.7 trillion United States dollars in, again, the year 2007. And in some of the advanced knowledge economies, such as the United States, for example, according to the reports of the Federal Reserve Board, there is now more investment in intangible assets than there is in tangible assets across the whole economy. So that is one thing that we are seeing, and that for us in our little world of intellectual property means that we are seeing a great surge in demand for property rights on knowledge. So around the year now there are some 1.8 million patent applications every year, some 600,000 design applications every year, and some 3.3 applications for new brands or trademarks around the world every year. Okay, a second major change transformation we're seeing, I think, in the landscape is a geopolitical one. The geography of technology production is changing, and it's changing extremely rapidly. China is now the third largest investor in absolute terms in research and development. Indeed, I believe this year it may overtake Japan as the second, to become the second largest. If you look at Asia, generally 45% of the world's engineering and science graduates are coming out of Asia right now. And we are seeing that, of course, in particular in the area of intellectual property. In terms of international patent applications, again, some 15 years ago, if you took Northeast Asia, namely Japan, China, and the Republic of Korea, they were responsible for 7.6% of international patent applications. Last year, that was 29.2%. So this is an extraordinary transformation. It is almost one-third of the world's technology using this particular measure, and I think if you look at scientific articles, you find a very similar set of statistics. Using this particular measure that is being produced in Japanese, Chinese and Korean. A third thing I think that we need to take note of, and it's to some extent a consequence of globalization, the movement of people, but it's also to some extent the consequence of technology and communications technologies that are now available, is that we see a great internationalization of science and technology, and science and technology production. So, now you find that some 22% of scientific articles around the world are co-authored by persons in different countries, internationally co-authored. And that compares, well, it's three times higher than the number of internationally co-authored articles that you found in 1985. If you look at students and the movements of students' populations, again, because the statistics are there, you can say that within the OECD there are three times as many foreign students now than there were in 1980. And in the years 2000 to 2006, the number of foreign students within the OECD countries doubled. So great movements we see of students around the world. And we see that, of course, translated into technology because we see that 15% of the international patent applications that are filed concern inventions that were made outside the country that is from which the application was filed. It's another measure of internationalization, if you like. So a fourth, then, feature, I think, of this landscape, the international landscape, to which I would like to refer, is a very radical, I think, shift, again, in the model of innovation. And the arrival of so-called open innovation models. Now, broadly speaking, we can say that open innovation is the tendency for enterprises to look outside themselves to satisfy their innovation needs. So whereas, if you like, crudely speaking, in the 20th century, the tendency was to satisfy, for a firm to satisfy its innovation needs by its own research and development programs, in the 21st century, it is much more the case that they will partner, collaborate, connect with other enterprises and be involved in various forms of open innovation in order to satisfy their innovation needs. And the means of production of knowledge, if you like, has shifted from the individual to the group and from the single institution to the multiple multiple institutions and from the national to the international. And that is a very interesting, of course, set of developments that we see, again, as a consequence of communication technology improvements, which facilitate these collaborative partnerships and also the movement of people. The final thing that perhaps I would like to mention in terms of the innovation landscape as we see it at the moment is development and the position of developing countries. Now, while the geopolitical or geographical changes that I mentioned mean that there have been a number of changes, and of course I have been very summary in my description of them, and it is a much more complex landscape indeed, but while there have been some changes, we do still notice extraordinary differences in the availability of and access to knowledge around the world. And I can give you one measure, which is comparing apples and oranges, really. It's not comparing the same thing. But there were five corporations that spent more on research and development, over $7 billion in a single year, than the individual GDPs of some 50 LDCs in the world. So more in terms of producing new knowledge in expenditure than was available to those countries for all of their public needs of infrastructure, health, education, and so on. So massive differences we still see around the world in access to knowledge and accessibility. Okay, then perhaps just a few words, if I may, on the consequences or some of the consequences of these developments in the innovation landscape for us who live in international organisations. And I think the first point that I would like to make is that, of course, this is all happening so quickly, so very quickly, and the changes are so very radical in certain respects. And one could go on to elaborate changes in technology more generally and what they mean. But it's so very quick, very rapid, that I think it poses a great challenge of relevance for us in the international public sector. You know, how can we, as public international institutions designed in, largely speaking, broadly speaking, another era, how can we be agile enough for this connected, collaborative, and globalised world where the innovation landscape is changing so very quickly? And I think it's a very important question. It's not merely an academic reflection, because if we are not sufficiently agile, then I think the possibility for influencing public policy in these areas will be somewhat limited. Many positions in public policy are likely to be taken by default. Default because there is no public, publicly developed response, but by default, by the market and by technology. And of course, it does, I think, throw out a challenge to the relevance of multilateral institutions to ensure that the policy responses indeed are developed in multilateral institutions and not in other instances, whether they be purely the market sector or indeed bilaterally or plurilaterally. More generally, moving away from that point, I think one of the other consequences that it has for international organisations, and particularly for we in the field of intellectual property, is that we need to think very carefully about the instruments or the vehicles that we use for international cooperation. And traditionally, of course, going back over 100 years in the case of the World Intellectual Property Organization, going back over 100 years, the vehicle of international cooperation was the treaty, agreements. And that was very much the life of the World Intellectual Property Organization, really, for its first 100 years. But in this rapidly moving landscape, treaties, of course, take a very long time to negotiate, and they create only possibilities, generally speaking. But what we see with so much action is that we need more than just possibilities. We need actually action undertaken at the international level in many instances. And I would like to give the example from a completely different field of the social networking platforms of Twitter and Facebook. Twitter and Facebook managed in a very short period of time, 6 to 12 months, to engage such an international participation that you might ask, if you had concluded a treaty and said, please, use treaty, use Twitter or use Facebook, would you have got the same response? In other words, the capacity to influence behaviour is actually informed in this interconnected world very much often by platforms that are provided rather than edicts that are given. And that brings me, I think, to the point that one of the things that I think we can very usefully do in the international community is to provide global infrastructure. Global infrastructure in terms of global public assets. Let me be a little bit more specific as to what I mean by this. If you go back to the geopolitical changes that are taking place in respect of technology production, you see that there is a big question now of the linguistic diversity of technology. Nearly 30% is being produced in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. And for several hundred years, the language of technology production was European. So this is a major change in the landscape. How is a small and medium enterprise going to cope with that, and how is it going to have access to the technology? One way is Google Translate. And it is another example of, if you like, the response, the policy, default position being provided by a market development. Another way is by a global public asset that is developed in a collaborative manner for machine-assisted translation. And it is an extremely important area. There are other examples that we have of providing access to technology databases. I think it also means, in addition to the broad infrastructure that is needed for participation in the knowledge economy, that another vehicle for international cooperation, which will be very, very important, or is very, very, very important, and we see this deployed very much and very effectively within UNIDO, is platforms or projects in relation to specific areas. Now, we have several that are underway in WIPO, which are, again, aimed at increasing participation in the knowledge economy. Let me give you a couple of examples, if I may. One is an access to research and development for innovation database that we have put together with the international scientific, technical and medical publishers, whereby they make available free of charge to anyone in a least developed country, and at a very modest price to anyone in one of 58 countries falling within the low and middle income of the categories of the World Bank, scientific periodicals and reviews, which if you took out a commercial subscription for, would cost you $400,000 a year. So it is a very concrete example of giving access to knowledge and trying to do something about the knowledge gap. A second example I could give you is in the area of the visually impaired or the blind. Now, it's generally considered that the blind, the visually impaired, have access to only 5% of published works within a reasonable time, access in accessible formats. And so we are again working in this instance on a platform between, on the one hand, the International Publishers Association, and on the other hand, the World Blind Union, to improve that statistic, to have publications in accessible formats made available to the visually impaired communities all around the world. And it is a practical platform through which this improvement in welfare can be achieved. A further example is in the area of traditional knowledge, which is of major significance in particular to the developing countries. And we have, on the one hand, a legislative exercise, if you like, that is underway within WIPO to improve the international architecture of the intellectual property system so that the intellectual property system addresses not just a knowledge base that is Western, but a knowledge base that is universal or global and includes traditional knowledge systems. But in addition to that, there has been extremely fine architecture put together, in fact, by the Indian government to create a digital library of traditional knowledge, which is a platform also for entering into collaborative arrangements with industry for sharing under certain circumstances and in return for remuneration traditional knowledge. And we are in the process of working with the Indian government to see to what extent we may be able to apply that architecture with the permission of the Indian authorities to other developing countries to develop their assets in the area of knowledge. Let me move away from platforms and say, if I may, make two final remarks. Besides vehicles of international cooperation, I think one of the other tasks that we have not fully comprehended yet and that we need to work on both at WIPO but generally as an international community is trying to understand better or to map better the knowledge economy and the innovation process. I don't think we have a ready formula for what innovation, the innovation process, really is and what the various elements of the knowledge economy are. We know that it covers at least the educational system, a regulatory framework, infrastructure, functional markets, including capital markets, and capacity. But we need, I think, to have a better recipe or mapping of the landscape of innovation and the knowledge economy. And in this respect, we believe at WIPO that one of the vehicles that can be very useful for, in particular, developing countries is to have a national strategy for innovation and intellectual property. Because innovation itself is, of course, not just a technical matter, but it is now a matter that covers also designs and branding in order to have the products of, in particular, developing countries shared more broadly or available more broadly on global markets. If national strategies are developed, we think that's a very good vehicle for making the intellectual property system more relevant to the national development objectives of each country. My final word concerns very specifically transfer of technology. I think that I've been trying to talk about transfer of technology in a different framework in all of my remarks. But I hope that it is apparent from what I've said that the arrival of open innovation offers great opportunity for, in particular, the developing countries, for sharing in the transfer of technology in ways that are very different from perhaps those that we imagined throughout the course of the 20th century. There are open source projects as one example, but open innovation isn't confined just to open source projects. It concerns all forms of collaborative, scientific and technical ventures. In these, intellectual property plays a very important role in defining the rights and obligations of multiple participants in collective knowledge generation and knowledge sharing projects. But it also provides an opportunity also for developing countries, which was not there previously. But to participate in that opportunity, of course, then the developing countries need the infrastructure. that is necessary for participation, and they need, in particular, capacity building. I finish with one example in this regard, and that is an example from Kenya. And I think, if my pronunciation can be forgiven, it is called the Ushahidi project. And it is a platform that was put together basically on using mobile telephony. So now, as you are aware, there's some 4.2 billion subscriptions for mobile telephones around the world now, and it has completely transformed the ways of doing business in many, many countries around the world. But this platform relies on the signals that are given or sent from mobile telephones for certain purposes, and it puts them together to create a map of the signals. And it was deployed with great effect in Haiti in respect of the disaster after the earthquake, because people were able to signal their locations and the platform was able to create a map. And that was a practical example of a platform that was put together, a practical platform that was of the sort that I was speaking of earlier, that was put together in this instance in Kenya, and it has been made available very effectively elsewhere in the world. So I think the new landscape brings with it certainly challenges, but also many, many opportunities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, General Gary. We open it for questions, interaction, questions from the floor. I will ask a couple of them. With the open innovation model, have you seen some concrete cases of such partnership, for example, in manufacturing around the world?
Yes, I think certainly. Of course, it started perhaps in the information technology industry or sector, and that is where you saw these projects that resulted in, for example, OpenOffice as a suite of software available. It's really a collaborative, so in a certain sense it's manufacturing, but manufacturing in the IT sector. I think we're seeing it also in terms of a number of public-private partnerships, and that is a feature, I think, that is enabled by the new landscape, public-private partnerships, where there is a sharing of if you like, inputs, but also a sharing of the benefits.
Yes, Sule.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for the very knowledgeable talk. And actually, whenever talk about this technology transfer is mentioned, it brings many questions with it. Simply because the level of awareness of technology differs widely from country to country, place to place. And when it is considered, I mean technology transfer is considered, then an important question presents itself, and that is what level of technology that we're willing to transfer. Or imported to another country are using. Appropriate is always the answer, very obviously, but again, how is appropriate level is defined? And here comes the consideration of a number of factors. One is, what are the governmental policies pertaining to job creation, high-tech, which is high-tech means low jobs, i.e. more unemployment. And the other is availability of infrastructure. Is there the reliable, energy resources, maybe? And number three is availability of highly qualified or qualified and trained human resources. You know, these are very important issues relating to technology transfer. We just cannot talk about technology transfer without considering them. And here comes an important role, I would say, for the UNIDO or the allied organization in facilitating or bridging the gap between the countries that innovate or introduces new technologies and the countries that uses them new technologies. You know, because you need to furnish the platform at these LDCs countries or developing countries before you launch new technologies. So I think it's a lot of work needs to be done in this area, and I hope to hear your views on this issue. Thank you.
Well, I agree very much with what you've said. Indeed, your description of the elements that are necessary in order for a successful transfer of technology to take place. And as I had mentioned, we are placing a great deal of emphasis on the construction of the virtual infrastructure, if you like, that facilitates a greater participation. And, of course, on capacity building. I think that we have been through a long period internationally in which we've spoken a lot about transfer of technology, but we perhaps haven't been very successful at it. I personally believe that the sorts of practical projects that are undertaken by UNIDO and the sorts of practical projects that we hope to collaborate with UNIDO on are very good ways of facilitating the transfer of technology, and that emphasis on practice and achieving concrete results is in many ways one of the biggest contributions that we're able to make from the international public sector, given that we are dealing with assets that frequently are not owned by governments. So we have to create a facilitating environment that is conducive to that, and we have to construct the capacity, both human and infrastructural, in order to enable the transfers of technology to take place. And, of course, in one area in particular, we're very much aware, in the area of green technology, we face a massive challenge for the transfer of technology, because we know that a technology that is carbon neutral or carbon free that is deployed in one country only is of relatively little utility unless it is deployed across the world, since it is a global challenge that we are confronting in this regard. So our capacity to put together practical programs for this, I think, immensely complex and difficult task of essentially transforming everything that we see out there, the whole economy from a carbon-based to a carbon, ultimately carbon-neutral and carbon-free economy, is one that concerns technology, and it is going to test our capacity as an international system to be able to ensure those technology flows occur.